Those are man-tools, and this pure hatred they have of us, that is unusual. The Gavani I saw in the jungles of Faris were not overly fond of men, but they didn't go out of their way to give us problems either. The great ghost could be an avenging god, a lot like Rimi was for the East Islanders, or Brigga is for us. Yes, Brigga is a fire goddess, and the patron of bakers, smiths, and chandlers. But she's also a goddess of vengeance. We get a lot of use out of our minor divinities. Then I had to stop and explain how the inhabitants of the three small islands to the east of Vor, descendants of Merwini shipwreck victims who had become pirates, had fought against the Empire for decades at sea, under the theocracy of Rimi, after their uncooperative priest king had been assassinated by imperial spies back in the Middle Majocracy period. The Rimi cult still practices today, I'm told, though without the fervor or bloodlust for vengeance shown in centuries past. So, this great ghost, who probably is a god of vengeance, has some sort of physical form or an avatar who is leading this war, he suggested, thinking. I had to admit, I was impressed. I had seen plenty of far more experienced war magi take a while to come to the same sort of reasonable conclusion. So it appears. The avatar is more likely. He's probably a great general or tribal chieftain, who is also a shaman, who lucked into a horde of Irianite. That isn't unknown. In fact, that's sort of how the Majocracy was founded, by some accounts. Too bad we don't have a priestess of Trig here. It is said they can keep any evil at bay. Again I shook my head and smiled at the naivete of youth. Not to dispute the teachings of Trig, Tyndall, but a priest has no more or less power than any other man, even of the Great Mother. Perhaps spiritual power. There are some temples who have magical orders in them. But a priest is just a man. A priestess is just a woman. Without Rajira, or the presence of a divinity, their power is cultural. Besides, who is to say the goblins are evil? The question shocked him, and rocked him to the core. But they attack us for no reason. They slaughter our people and burn our towns. How can they not be evil? He asked, astonished at my intellectual temerity. To you, perhaps they are. But by those standards, your ancestors were just as evil. When the Alshari warriors you are descended from came to this valley, they burned Gavani villages, slaughtered Gavani warriors, and drove the few survivors into the mountains, where they had to fight the elements and each other to survive. In their minds, they are just taking back what is theirs, from us evil Humani. That's different, Tyndall snapped. The Duke of Alshar granted us this land. It was ours, not theirs. And who gave it to him? Not the poor Gavani who lived here. They'd never heard of Alshar or the Duke. They lived here for thousands of years, and one day they get invaded by a bunch of men with swords and horses who have been told that they own their land. Of course, they fought tooth and nail, just like we're doing, to try to keep it out of the hands of evil. I don't care, Tyndall said defiantly. I'm not going to leave my home for a bunch of stinking, stupid goblins to take over. We showed them today and we'll show them again. Tyndall, I said softly, don't underestimate them. I learned as a war mage that you must respect your enemy in order to defeat him. To not give your foe the respect that he is due gives him an opening in your defenses that he can exploit. These Gavani are not only worthy of your respect, they will demand it. When I fought Raiken today, the only advantage that I had over him was better training and quicker wits, and a few score of cavalry. It could just as easily have gone the other way. So far, we've been lucky. The great ghost, or whoever is leading them, has just sent in scouting and raiding parties so far, the mere vanguard of his invasion. The real armies will come all too soon, and when they do, you'll see why bravado and courage are two entirely different things. I don't think I really convinced him, but I hoped I'd given him something to think about. I wasn't defending the Gavani exactly, but I was empathetic to their history. I'm certain humanity would have done the same in their situation, or at least some of it. Punishing them with moral judgments for what we ourselves would do seemed like the height of hypocrisy. That night, I sat straight up, not recommended in a hammock, my heart pounding and a vicious sweat breaking out on my face and body. My tunic was soaked through. I had a dream about Riken, back on the battlefield, his bloody face turned to me in defiant anger, his voice echoing in my head. He is coming. I didn't know who he was, but I was suddenly so afraid of him that I had wet myself. Also, not recommended in a hammock. Chapter 8. Vauxhall Castle Under Siege. The brief thrill of our minor victory was completely gone 3 days later, when the siege began in earnest. It started when a cavalry patrol was ambushed not a mile from the castle doors, killing 10 men, 8 horses, and our jubilant mood. The survivors beat a hasty retreat back to Vauxhall Castle, where our archers turned the Gervani pursuing them back with volleys of arrows. That was the last time we were able to freely send our horsemen out. From that point on, we were really under siege, not just preparing for one. The weather was not helping, of course. It was being magically manipulated by the goblins, keeping a thick cloud cover over the entire valley, which made it seem like twilight, even at noon. This was for their benefit, as it allowed them to put many, many more warriors on the field when the bright light of day was held in abeyance. It occasionally rained from the clouds, but mostly it was just dark and dreary all the time. It depressed our warriors and frightened our civilians. Night was almost a relief, except for the fact that it was at night when the Gervani were most likely to try to scale our walls. In an effort to counter this dreariness, I started casting mage lights in strategic locations. This is easier than it sounds. Mage lights are arcanely powered spheres of light that produce no heat and no smoke. Nothing actually gets burnt, you see. Most people don't realize that light is just a form of energy that can be produced from just about any matter. There is a whole host of technical terms in Imperial for the subject, called photomancy, but the upshot is, if you cause a piece of matter to be charged with magical energy in just the right way, it will emit light. Hence, mage light. The more energy, the more light. If you alter the spell slightly and use a rune or two, you can pump an object full of energy and have it released slowly over time. Useful stuff, but usually beyond the capabilities of the average spellmonger. Me, I plastered mage lights all over the entire castle, gleeful at how easy it was with Eirionite. Plus, it kept our spirits up and kept stray goblins from hiding in the shadows. At first, the bands that attacked us were the usual screaming, jabbering horde that would rush forward to the edge of the moat, hurl a few javelins and rocks over the walls before retreating a safe distance, usually carrying some wounded, as our little archer company was getting better with practice. Gradually, though, the black knot of Gervani who hovered just out of bowshot grew. By day 4 of the siege, there were almost 1,000 of them, and their sorties on the castle became more organized. So we prepared to repel them. For most, that meant drilling and practicing with our weapons. Our peasant militia had been so augmented by volunteers that we did not have enough trained warriors to lead them. Thanks to my shopping trip, however, they were all adequately armed, if not armored. Many also had their own bows, and the butts got plenty of use as they thudded practice arrows against straw effigies. But mostly they worked with the plain spears and short infantry swords from the castle arsenal. They drilled constantly in the inner bailey, working on small unit tactics with the black flag and our mercenary infantry. This basically consisted of rushing forward in a mob and killing everything in sight, which sounds like poor military tactics, except that this was a siege, and anything less than that level of viciousness could kill us all. For me, preparing involved casting complicated spells in anticipation of the inevitable arrival of more powerful Gervani shamans. Magical warfare comes down to various levels of attack and defense spells. It is quite straightforward in that way. If your offensive bolt is stronger than your enemy's shields, he goes down. If it's weaker, he gets the chance to chew you up. But there are thousands of subtle variations on this theme that make mage war a tricky and lethal business, and war magic a powerful help to it. Like any other style of warfare, To win, you must assess your own strengths and weaknesses as well as your enemies, and then concentrate on their weak spots while protecting your own. Our weak spot? Little hope for reinforcements, and too few magi to begin with. Their weak spot? Unsophisticated magic that concentrated a great deal of power in the hands of the individual shaman. To help our case, I had spent much of my waking time, and Tyndall's, when we were not lighting up the place, building a scale model of the castle and the surrounding countryside. This model was as accurate as I could make it, including elevations, types of material, and scale. While the effigy looked like a child's toy more than a sophisticated magical tool, it was a very good model for our situation, and it provided an excellent metaphor for the castle. It also took up a great deal of space in my workroom. But by using it as a kind of altar, a magical staging area, I was able to prepare a lot more damage to our besiegers than I would otherwise. Mostly, I used it in gathering intelligence. By marking out the area where the Gavani were setting up their camps around the castle, I was able to see exactly how many and what kind of troops they were assembling without leaving my quarters. The relative comfort of scrying and spying like that didn't make up for the result. It wasn't a pretty picture. On average, more than 500 Gavani were arriving outside the castle every day. By the third full day of the siege, I saw that they weren't just the scouts and vanguard troops that we'd seen up to now. Very large, almost man-sized Gavani warriors, complete with leather armor and swords and vicious attitudes, began marching into their camps, chanting aggressive-sounding war songs to the cheers of their fellows. Using mage sight and interference, as well as scrying, I learned that they were given the best rations, the best accommodations, and seemed in charge of the military situation. On day 4, some sort of general showed up, flanked by 2 shamans and accompanied by 2-wheeled wagons, pulled by a strange variety of draft animals, and protected by an entourage of big, ugly goblin bodyguards. It was the first time I had seen the Gavani employ oxen or other domesticated beasts, some clearly looted from some human farmstead, others raised themselves. The wagons were filled with supplies, mostly dried roots and salted meat, weapons and tools. Tools with which they could make siege engines. That was not good news. To my knowledge, the Gavani didn't utilize fortifications the way we did, and therefore would not know how to break through them. But I suppose after 200 years of studying the situation, you pick up a few things. After bringing this information to the attention of Sire Kusi, he doubled the firewatch and ordered me to do something about it. Well, ordered is a strong term. He requested that I make certain that as few siege engines as possible be deployed against his fortress, seeing as how it costs a literal fortune to build, and it was the only thing between us and certain slaughter. So I did. Their weakness was that they hadn't actually started to build any siege engines yet. That didn't mean that they were unprotected. The shamans who accompanied that column had learned from their predecessors' mistakes, or perhaps they were just a better class of witch doctor. But those encampments had powerful wards on them. Wards I couldn't lightly break. Either way, my first few attempts to burn their wagons at a distance failed miserably. Luckily, I'm not a one-trick foot wizard. As most of the tools involved were metal, I decided to alter my tactics and use water and not fire against them. That was a more subtle and harder to defend against type of war magic. I told Tyndall of my plan, explained the magical principles behind it, and together we cast a spell that caused the rapid oxidation of everything in those wagons. When I mean rapid, I mean that by the next morning nearly every axe head, adze, pick, and shovel in that convoy was rusted to near uselessness. Iron blades had hidden flaws that made them snap when used. Shovels broke in two when any amount of pressure was put on them. Adzes had their edges rusted to the point where they were useless for serious work. In the meantime, Sir Kay, the Dur Castellan, ostensibly in charge of the castle's defense, had assigned Garkescu the duty of making life as uncomfortable as possible for the goblins. You might think I was irked at this plum assignment being handed off to the competition, but I had to admit, when it came to being a professional pain in the ass, Gargescu was the obvious choice. Even Sir Kay could see that. On the more practical side, Gargescu did have years of experience with the everyday types of spells a spellmonger sold, while I was a relative newcomer to the business. His work gave him an advantage. After all, if you can cast a spell to keep insects away, can it be that hard to cast a spell to draw them closer? He did, and the Gurvani camp was infested with irritating pests and stinging bugs for weeks afterward. He threw spells to make their foods moldy and sour the bitter type of beer they drink for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He had spells that sent the odor of putrescence waft through their camp, and spells that produced blood-curdling sounds during the day, making it difficult for them to sleep. I found he was especially good at diseases, as any good village spellmonger should be, and by day 6 of the siege, 1 out of 3 Gurvani was stricken with nasty diarrhea. Between the bad food, the rusted tools, the insects, the sleep deprivation, the stinks and the shits, those would-be invaders were getting further and further behind schedule for their mission, that is, slaughtering all of us. I admit, I was impressed, and said so in front of Sire Kusi, which helped my immediate relations with Gargescu tremendously. Sir Kusi was not idle during this slowdown. Twice he sent cavalry sorties out to harass the teams of Gavani engineers, who were trying to put together a catapult, or some such, just out of bowshot. Our people were repelled each time, but we delayed their start for at least another week, and took only light casualties. The fateful day came, however, when they were able to get one lonely trebuchet kind of working, and we could see them, with mage sight, having a really good time flinging rotten pumpkins over our walls. The trouble was, the machine couldn't handle a missile heavier than that without falling apart. The peasants began making jokes about pumpkin raids, and a few of the more far-sighted among them dutifully cleaned up the exploded mess and planted the seeds in pots and barrels around the castle. Before another week passed, the goblin army outside had tripled in size, with no end of reinforcements in sight. Someone high up in the hairy hierarchy decided that they were being made fools of by our subtle magic and big ugly horsemen. That night, day 10 of the siege, if my records are accurate, the goblins started making a mad dash for the moat, throwing in bundles of faggots, and then dashing away again. Our archers pegged plenty of them, and added their corpses to the refuse in the moat, but plenty more made it without injury. After a few hours of this, there was a swampy bridge of sticks that allowed a few of the little buggers to cross the moat, only to be shot at the base of the wall by our snipers. That didn't deter them. They continued trying to backfill the moat, and they continued dying. We could not let that stand and expect to survive. After I thoroughly scanned the area for hidden traps, we lowered a dozen men down from the walls on ropes, and they undid much of the filling. The bundles of sticks we hauled up to be dried and used for firewood. The bodies of the goblins were looted for iron and decapitated, their heads used for the traditional morale purpose. We even got back most of the arrows we expended. It went like that for another week. At night, the Gurvani would try to chew through our defenses, both military and magical, and during the day we would undo most of the work that they had done. We were holding our own and trying to defend against the inevitable ennui. But their army kept growing. As we observed, the new troops were even better trained than their earlier brethren, marching in columns like a human army, and using superior man-weapons. Among the new units was a full company of archers, which made our defenses a little more costly to man. While the Gurvani bows were shorter, they also seemed to be stronger in weight for their size than ours, so that their average bowshot was just a few score feet under ours. They also used a shorter, lighter arrow. Of course, we had a height advantage that they didn't, but they were figuring things out a lot quicker than I expected, and that had me worried. Clearing the moat became a little more dangerous for us, but the supplies of soggy firewood continued to be gathered every morning. Scrying their encampments was becoming more difficult, even with the model. Their shamans had started putting up shields that obstructed the view of a meadow just beyond the regular Gurvani camps, so I figured the likelihood of there being something nasty brewing was high. The Gravani shields were too tough for me to remove by brute force. Directly contesting a spell with any mage who has a chunk of Irianite is hard, even if you have your own chunk. After they lost a few camps to raids, it seemed that the two were taking it in turns maintaining the shields of every camp. They also began taking stronger countermeasures against Garkescu's inspired annoyance spells, which meant that their troops were in a much better mood. As far as getting any more messages out, that was just unlikely to happen. I don't know how they did it, but I could no longer access the other world. That disturbed me. The lack of strategic intelligence was also bothering me. In our daily council of war at the castle, his staff, myself included, kicked around ideas about how to cure it in Kusi's study. Most of the conventional military leaders were quite content just to sit back and wait for the Gavani to try to break the siege and then die gallantly defending the castle. But I wasn't. Sire Kusi, who was aging a year for every day that passed, agreed with me and authorized a reconnaissance action. So on day 15, I led a small raiding party over the walls at noon. While the goblins were able to fight under the overcast skies, they still disliked the brightness of the noon sun peeking through. I chose 20 Krynrok for my band, led by Firtak, and we conducted a raid of our own. The barbarian mercenaries were eager for war. They painted themselves various mottled shades of green, blue and grey, with mud and herbal preparations, and added some green leafy foliage to help disguise themselves. I added a glyph of unnoticeability to each one, just in case. You often hear in old stories about how the spies of the Majocracy used invisibility spells to slip by enemy lines, but at the Academy, they insisted that this was crap and ancient politics. Invisibility is a terribly complicated photomantic spell. It involves bending light, which means harnessing truly titanic forces, and doesn't protect against any sounds you might make. Unnoticeability, on the other hand, is fairly straightforward. The key to sneakiness is not to not be seen, it is to not be noticed, a small but important distinction. The glyph I used was a War College standard and therefore probably unknown to the Gravani. It's a blue magic spell that works on the minds of your foes, and simply causes them not to pay attention to the enemy sneaking through the shrubbery behind them. To that end, it actually worked better than any invisibility spell I'd heard. Just not for the Gavani. Whether you lived to see them or not, you could still smell them. The Gavani are not overly fond of baths. I snuck through the outer defenses of the camp with my merry little band of homegrown raiders and into the edges of their busy encampments for a few nights. Security was lax, even by sloppy Gavani standards, with few pickets or patrols this close to the castle. You didn't need to be an adept to find your way around them. I was surprised how adept the Krynrok were at this type of operation. The warriors made nary a sound as they moved. Firtak explained that the Krynrok are good hunters, used to stealthy movement. As long as you didn't worry about the smell of rancid butter, they were able to move about without much notice. Despite the darkness, the ground was littered with thousands of goblins sleeping with their hairy cloaks thrown over their faces. The day shift. There were tents here and there made of crudely woven mountain hemp, but they seemed to be designed more for protecting equipment and supplies than housing troops. Several times I had to step over a snoring goblin to keep going, and on two hair-raising occasions, my boot slipped, and I accidentally kicked one. Each time, the Gervan in question snorted and rolled over, oblivious to our presence. Why didn't we just slit some throats and retreat? We weren't there to start trouble. We were there to gather information. I had my barbarian band hide in the brush while I crept into the center of their camp, to the slightly more ornate tent that I guessed, correctly, was the headquarters of the besieging general and his staff. I found a comfortable spot behind a barrel of that nasty bitter beer and started taking notes about the size and nature of the army that faced us. About an hour later, I crept back to my barbarians. I was shaking. We made it back to Beauval Castle without incident, and I had three glasses of wine before reporting to Sire Kusi's war council. I had a hard time understanding them, I admitted, but of this there is no doubt. There are no less than 16 shamans now, all of whom are armed with witch stones. I reported quietly, there are thousands, perhaps tens of thousands more goblins coming, and each wave seems better armed for war than the last. They have foraged or made tools, so they are building a new collection of siege engines. Of what sort? Sir Kay asked, curious. Catapults thrice as large as the pumpkin thrower they started with, battering rams, protective frameworks, and at least 4 great siege towers tall enough to surmount the wall and cross the moat. We may have as long as 4 days, probably 3, before they make a serious advance on our position. Sir Olvi, one of Kusi's pet knights, and likely a distant relative, stood up and made an impassioned speech about dying valiantly in defense of the land and the people. Very poetic, but unproductive. Ideas about how not to die valiantly were tossed around, but there didn't seem to be any clear answer. I certainly didn't have one that could contend with all of those forces arrayed against us. I went to bed and tried to catch some sleep before the inevitable nocturnal skirmish. The attacks became more intense each night. We repelled them easily enough at first, but we started to lose men, men who couldn't be replaced. I did my part by illuminating the areas under attack with bright mage lights, so that our archers could see their targets, and occasionally took a turn on the battlements with my warstaff, as did the rest of the magical corps. But it still did not dissuade them, or drive them from the field. 4 nights after I had made my first daring foray, the first real siege engine started inching their way toward the walls, surrounded by a sea of black, furry faces. Stones were flung at our walls at far greater velocities than the pumpkin thrower had been capable of. They did little against the strong walls of the keep, but occasionally they would land in the outer bailey and hurt some of the peasants. The civilians soon learned which areas of the bailey were dangerous, and which were effectively shielded by the walls. The catapults and the ballistae didn't worry me much. Every now and then they would lob a pumpkin full of flaming oil into the castle, but our anti-arson spells and vigorous fire prevention program made this more of a bother than a threat. What worried me were the 5 siege towers that loomed like newly made mountains in the distance, mountains pulled by oxen that were approaching at the rate of 20 yards an hour. The major advantage of a castle in a siege is the fact that the defenders have this whopping big wall to throw stuff down from. It gets pretty discouraging to the attackers if they get a rain of rocks and arrows on their heads every time they charge the gates. Ladders can be employed to climb the walls, but seeing as how easy it is for 1 or 2 burly infantrymen to push the top of the ladders over with the poles that were scattered across the battlements for just such a purpose, the Govani had stopped that foolishness quickly enough. Siege towers are made for getting around that problem. Basically, they are large wooden towers on wheels or rollers that can be pushed up against the wall of a castle, or as close as the attackers can get it. Once in position, they drop a plank or bridge over the battlements and over the moat, effectively eliminating the height advantage of the defenders. These were worse than normal towers, though, I saw, as each one had at least 1 or 2 shamans in their peak to direct and magically aid the attack. I could see them by mage sight, and could feel their witch stones approaching in my bones. It was easy enough to see their plan. Once their shock troops took a section of battlement, they would be free to lay about them with bolt after bolt of destructive magic. Those towers had to be stopped, somehow. We tried shooting fire arrows at them, to no avail. The goblins had been smart enough to cover the exteriors with wet hides and blankets, and the same sort of anti-arson spells we were using. We tried shooting them with rocks from our own ballistae, but the mass of the stones just wasn't enough to do much damage to the thick oak, hickory, and redwood structures. Our archers concentrated their fire on the oxen that pulled the towers into place, and their drovers. While fun, it was futile, as they had plenty of other drovers to replace the fallen, and ate the dead oxen. The towers were well protected magically, as I found out after wasting several standard shock bolts and fire bolts and such on them. All of our attempts to smash the menacing structures were in vain. They just kept coming. Like a dagger being slowly drawn across our collective throats, they inched forward. We prepared as good a defense as possible, but we all knew what our chances were if even one of those towers made it. One breach in our defenses would be all it would take to let the growing horde of goblins inside. I paced the top of my tower, staring out at the glacial progress of our foes, and tried to think of a plan while the civilians prepared for the assault below me. The possibility of dropping really heavy rocks on them had occurred to me. With the two witch stones I had, I could probably lift a boulder magically for a while. The problem was that it would take most of my power and all my concentration, leaving me wide open for a counterattack. I couldn't take that chance, not when I wasn't sure of the outcome. I could also summon a nasty storm. Weather magic is fairly easy, but very dangerous and harmful to nature. But that would only delay them, and make life for our folk miserable as well. Besides, the dark clouds that hid the sun from us for so many days were clearly under their control. The answer came to me while I was showing Tyndall how to strap on his new mage blade over his shoulder, fixing each knot with a cantrip to keep it from slipping, which could prove annoying and deadly in battle. That's when the answer to our problem suddenly hit me. Things were better after we arrived at the outer defenses of Faris proper. After the jungle and the mountains, we would have fought with our lives just for a clean bath and a hot meal. That's almost what happened at first. More of a mob than an army, we attacked the Doge's storehouses, great brick fortresses full of food on the other side of the city from the port, where the main attack was expected. We slew the Farisi like vengeful spirits, and gorged ourselves on their rich, strange-tasting rations. After 3 days of rest and pillage on the outskirts of the city, we marshaled our resources and struck at the inner city in a highly coordinated attack with the fleet. The Farisi had not seriously considered that our little army of 3,000 might be a serious threat. As we never attacked the garrison until the odds were heavily in our favor, their losses were light, but strategically significant. When the final assault to capture the city was launched, the fleets of the five duchies pushed their way into the harbor and fought the Farisi squadrons to a standstill. Meanwhile, we used the leverage of our earlier raids to push behind the great encircling wall of the town and force the Doge to reposition his troops away from the harbor, which they desperately needed to defend. Caught between the two forces, even the mad mage's witchstone wasn't enough to keep us outside of the city walls and out of the docks. There were the usual lucky turns of events which contribute to a successful assault. Enemy stupidity happens in every military organization. Random factors falling in our favor. It helped our cause tremendously when their heavily bribed port commander led his marines against their former employers for the promise of a palace and a post in the new regime. The mad mage and his patron could only look on impotently while one half of their army attacked the other half. The battle and subsequent looting of the city was ugly, perhaps legendarily so. Then the veterans of the Long March pushed into the center of the city, and it was bloody. The Doge's best troops were mostly pirate marines, infantry on boats, and they were tough. The city watch was likewise tough, and toward the end of the 3-day battle for the city, even civilians were picking up arms to defend themselves as the battle devolved into house-to-house fighting. I don't like making war on civilians, but if a man has a spear in his hand, to me it looks like he just joined the army, and I didn't hesitate to cut him down or blast him into bits. I was too tired to pay attention to the bronze warrior's loyalties. For 3 solid days we fought them without rest or quarter. The landward army, including a few crack Kasari rangers, was responsible for capturing a good third of the city before the naval forces were able to overcome with heavy losses the port fortifications and take another third. By the end of the 3rd day of fighting, we controlled the waterfront, the town, and the farms and plantations around the city. But we weren't done until Oral Pratt and his sponsor, the Doge, was defeated. We rested and systematically sacked the city while our fearless leaders argued about strategy and tactics and politics. The only thing we didn't control was the Doge's palace, where the mad mage had his tower and 1,000 loyal crack troops. Our surprise attack turned into a siege. While this concerned the war marshal and his staff greatly, we grunts didn't care. We were pillaging. A city with the size, age, and wealth of Faris has a lot of accumulated treasure to steal. I know I got my share. The looting was amazing. We took everything of value, and there was plenty. Antiques from imperial times, gold, silver, brass, silks, fine wines, tapestries, everything. Faris was a stronghold of pirates and merchant princes, and the only poor people were the slaves, many of whom turned on their masters and welcomed us as liberators, then joined us in looting. They knew where the best of it was, after all. I did my share of looting myself, and even acquired a stylish residence when the previous occupant got himself killed defending it. When things settled down, about a week after the attack, three other war magi and I moved into the pleasant townhouse and caught up on our sleep, while the generals tried to figure out how to smoke the doge out of his fortified palace. But Oral Platt wasn't going to go quietly. Every few days the mad mage would unleash some new horror on us from his tower. We would defeat it, and then everyone would rest for a few days. Then we would try an attack, and he would beat it off with that damned witch stone of his. Then everyone would rest for a few days. One night I woke up to find the streets crawling with soldiers who had already been killed once. The mad mage had sallied himself with necromancy by animating the recently dead, of which there was an abundance, and throwing them at us to keep us occupied. Necromancy is one of those darker areas of magic that most nice wizards just don't talk about. But it isn't particularly hard, if you have enough power. It was horrifying to fight the living dead, especially if you encountered someone you once knew, and for whom you had grieved. The surprise zombie attack took us another 3 days to put down, and a special meeting of the entire Ducal Magical Corps was called to prevent similar spells in the future. 3 days after that, a mysterious plague broke out among the portside infantry. That took us another week to cure, and we lost almost 1,000 men to the fever, almost as many as we had in the invasion proper, or the Long March. The week after that, nothing wooden could come within bowshot of the Doge's citadel without bursting into flame. We lost several siege engines that way, and not a few engineers, and even fire retardant spells were useless against that kind of power. We figured the palace would be easy after the city, but the mad mage kept not dying, which was irritating. This went on for a month and a half, when a black mist that seemed alive crept out of the citadel to suffocate all who encountered it. The war marshal had had enough. He was losing men without gaining anything in battle against the mad mage. He called upon his own magi to do something about it. Finally, the famous Wenshari war mage, Master Loiko Vanaren, worked out a way to assault the palace and the citadel without slaughtering 1,000 of our men in the process. Just a few magi. I won't go into detail about the attack here, perhaps later, but the magical corps played a large role in the battle. That final battle was the greatest assembled collection of war magi since the fall of the Magocracy. Some of the finest magical warriors of my generation fought the Battle of the Doge's Tower. A special force from Group B assassinated the Doge once they broke into the palace, and the combined might of close to 2 dozen war magi finally contained the death-dealing mad mage. Master Loiko himself dueled the men, and ended up destroying the focus of a powerful spell at a crucial moment. The mad mage's head essentially exploded. We got the doors of the citadel open, and a flood of infantry came through to mop up the survivors. The next morning, to the cheers of his troops, the war marshal made his triumphant entrance into the castle on a white horse borrowed for the occasion. The banner of Faris was struck, and the ensigns of Alshar and Castal were raised. The last vestige of the Imperial Magocracy was conquered. Yay. Oh, sure, we had a minor guerrilla war to contend with. At least 5,000 Frisian troops had escaped into the jungle to form a resistance. But we held the city. Only 2/3 of us survived. But at the end of the battle it was the mad mage's head that was stuck on a pike, the Doge's palace a smoking ruin behind it. In the end, it was a crack squad of nearly invincible veteran war magi who penetrated his defenses and defeated him after a lengthy and deadly combat. The Battle of the Doge's Tower revealed what a witchstone could do up close in the heat of battle, and it was terrifying. The mad mage flung power around like a child throws a new ball, converting it into 100 deadly forces that struck our men. The spells he worked that night were potent enough to have burned out the brains of any normal mage foolish enough to try them. There was little pattern to the way he did it. They called him the Mad Mage for a reason, after all. So finding adequate defensive spells was more a matter of luck than skill. By contrast, he batted away our attacks as though we were flies until Master Loico Venarian found a way. The stuff of legends. The best battle magics, my instructors at the War College used to say, are the little subtle ones that your enemy doesn't see coming. My plan for the siege towers at Beauval Castle was along those lines. I talked it over with my apprentice for a while, ran it past Garkescu, and ran a simulation on the model in my quarters. Once I had come up with a fully developed plan, I presented it to the War Council and Sire Cusi. They loved it, and despite some misgivings about their role in it, they agreed. The next morning, two of the towers were within bowshot of the castle, and the other three were not. The bulk of the Gavani infantry had retired to their shady hollows to rest up for the big battle the next evening, leaving only a skeleton force to guard the towers, catapults, and ballistae that were still being moved by the day shift. By skeleton force, I meant about 8,000 or 9,000 Gavani warriors, far more than we could handle. But it also meant 10,000 or so less than we would face on the battlefield that night. Yes, the goblins had been arriving in that kind of strength. I called my magical corps to the top battlement of the main gate, which looked like the most centralized position facing the foe. I had the archers keep up some harassing fire, and they were doing pretty well, considering that most of them had only been shooting seriously for the last few weeks. Garkescu, his three apprentices, and Tyndall gathered around me on the battlements as I explained the spell, explaining their roles to each in turn. When I was done, Tyndall looked out doubtfully at the swarm of goblins beyond the wall.
"Master, are you certain this will work?"
I shrugged. "I have no idea, but I'm hopeful." He shook his head.
"Maybe we should have evacuated. That seems more sensible than this."
"While I dislike your apprentice's impertinence," Garkescu said solemnly, "I cannot fault his reasoning. If I knew that this was what we would be facing in this siege..."
"This is your home,"
I said evenly. "If you love it, it deserves to be defended. Don't worry. This spell should have an effect. Hopefully a dramatic one."
"Enough to break this damnable siege?" Garki asked skeptically. "Or are you expecting an army of relief from Duke Lengin for this forgotten little domain?"
"Perhaps he likes cheese,"
Rundal, his second apprentice, offered.
"A lot."
"Regardless of what help may or may not arrive, the defense of this castle rests with us," I said firmly. "If we all play our part and manage to make this work, we can set back the goblins' plans for weeks, perhaps long enough for help to arrive before winter sets in. But that won't happen if we run away. Now, do you all remember your roles? Each one is vital in its way." To Garkescu, I gave responsibility for our defense. He would do his best to deflect or absorb incoming magics, which shouldn't be too much of a problem until we were well into the spell. Once the shamans realized we were gathering a great working, they would throw everything but my Aunt Bibi's butter churn at us to stop us. This was something else Garkescu was pretty good at. Once I'd taught him a few simple defensive spells, he'd become very proficient in their use. He didn't even challenge my authority on the matter. I guess he was as scared as anyone else in the castle and hoped I could pull off a victory. To Tyndall, I gave the responsibility for masking what we were up to. He would play with the elemental cords, disguising our true spell behind a tapestry of interesting but misleading arcane signals. Nothing elaborate, just enough hints of spell elements to make them think we were hiding something big and powerful behind our wards. To two of Garki's three apprentices, I gave the task of helping me extend the range of the spell. A spell usually needs to be directed by a conscious mind if it is going to work properly, and while I'm pretty good at that sort of thing, we weren't talking about curing a bunion here. We had to affect more than 8,000 Gavani all at once. By using the minds of Garkescu's two senior apprentices to extend the range of the spell,
It was likely I could, I hoped, cover the entire force. The third, youngest, Urik, was in charge of general support. Me? I directed the whole thing. This is what imperially trained magi are best at, working in a group. It gives us an important edge over our shamanic or solitary colleagues. By working together in concert, we can not only raise and channel more power, we can individually concentrate on specific aspects of a spell, content in knowing that the others in the circle will handle their part without us. There is always the potential for failure, of course, as a hidden doubt in the mind of one person in the circle can cause a chain reaction that destroys the whole spell, sometimes explosively. But when it works well. I had my own doubts, but not in the circle. I had carefully selected each of the roles the others would play, and no one was assigned something that they couldn't handle. I set all of them to begin their meditations, while I spoke briefly with one of Kusi's officers, coordinating their mission with the result of our spell. This is more important than it sounds. Most war magi act as if regular warriors are only good for spell fodder, but I had learned better in Faris. If the magical corps and the infantry aren't properly coordinated, then the whole damn mission can blow up in your face and kill both divisions. When the Will the Lord in the Bailey signaled that he and his men were ready, I went back to the battlements and began the working. With a nod from me, my men each formed an apis, so that we could share power. More accurately, I would give them power, with a piece of Irionite in each fist. Power wasn't going to be an issue here for a change. Sharing it was. Instead of a standard apis, I formed a stelapis, a magical form that allows a single source to shunt power to many others. It was unusual in standard imperial magic. After all, the reason that the apis is so important is that it is rare for a single mage to be able to raise enough power for a really big spell. But we had learned the technique as part of our training all the same. Slowly, I drew power from the stones and sent it to be distributed, causing the stelapis to glow in my mage sight. It began to flow out to the apis of the others, and I relaxed and focused on keeping it moving. Garkescu began his portion of the spell, laying a thick sphere of defensive magic about our circle. When it was complete, he nodded once. Tyndall then began his spell. When I was convinced that there were sufficient signs to mislead any self-respecting Gavani shaman of our true purpose and counter it, I took a deep breath and started the major part of the work. I watched with detached interest through mage sight as the five towers crept closer, the Gavani catapults were towed into place, and thousands of goblins scurried across the field like ants on honey bread. This is where it would get tricky. I began to form in my mind the glyph Terror, the Unbinding. It was the polar opposite of Kere, the binding glyph that I'd used that morning on Tyndall's sword belt. Glyphs and runes have no innate power of their own. They are symbolic representations, visual and mental metaphors of abstract concepts. True, their shape usually has some relation to the concept. Terror looks kind of like two pieces of rope the moment they become untied. If you look at it right, for example. The concept behind terror is just that. Unbinding. Loosing. Used in conjunction with other glyphs, it can be used to express quite a range of ideas. For example, terror, drawn below the runes for rock and head, will help a spellmonger remove a rotten tooth from someone's head, although a barber's pliers help. Drawn above the runes for iron and secret, and most unhexed locks will fall open, as if you had used a key. It's a very useful basic cantrip that most magi know. What I was doing in this spell wasn't technically any more complicated than using it to unlace the bodice of an unsuspecting peasant lass, one of my favorite tricks at the academy. I was simply boosting the power by orders of magnitude. The glyph glowed in my mage sight, safely hidden behind Tyndall's obscuring shield. I let power flow like life's blood from the Irionite stones in my fists and directed it into the glyph, empowering it into activity, and soon it blazed in my mind like a righteous star. Still, I poured power into it, far past my unaugmented limits,
far past the point where any spell so simple had been powered before, to my knowledge. I could soon feel the residual power crackle the very air, making the hair on my scalp stand at attention. Hells, my very bones vibrated with the power. With one tiny part of my mind that wasn't busy maintaining the glyph or directing power, I saw that the three apprentices had done their parts. The field ahead of me was scattered with tiny blue pinpoints, like candle flames, visible only to us. That was Rundal, the middle apprentice, doing the casting. This was a control spell known to the Imperials as Urandra's Net. Every one of those thousands of points was essentially the same as the blue flame that Rundal had cast on the edge of the Merlun in front of us. Every one of those points reflected every other one, like a fisherman's net with mirrors at the juncture of each set of cords. That was all. It wasn't more complicated than that. When I saw all was prepared, I waited for the moment of Pavad, the time of timelessness. That's a more difficult concept to explain to folks who don't use magic. Someday, if I ever understand it completely, maybe I'll try to come up with a perfect metaphor for it. What it boils down to is that at some point during the casting of a spell of this nature, there is a single instant that is the perfect time to release the power and activate the spell, like a professional archer loosing his arrow between heartbeats. Old Madge, I know the time by experience. Every mage tries to release the spell at the time of Pavad, but essentially we're all guessing. I know I was. I did it anyway, moving the huge glowing glyph into the blue flame by force of will, releasing my breath and discharging the spell. By the principle of Urandra's Net, the glyph reflected itself to the tens of thousands of other blue flames. For all practical purposes, I had just cast the Terraglyph 1,000 times over the host of Gavanni at our door. The effect was sudden and explosive, and far exceeded my hopes. Everywhere among the Gavanni army, wherever there was a tied knot or a fastened belt, it came undone. The knots that held mace heads to handles were unraveled. The knots that held on their cloaks and rough armor became untied. Bowstrings snapped, and arrowheads and spear points fell off of their shafts. Shields fell away from their handles. Harnesses unbuckled and ropes frayed. In an instant, thousands of weapons and armor became completely useless. Most importantly, the siege towers that they had spent so many days building fell apart as the bindings that held them together ceased to function. Gavanni warriors and shamans proudly overseeing the battle fell from the towers to their deaths, while others were crushed under the tons of lumber suddenly raining down on them. At other points, the massive pressure that was contained in the yards of sinew that formed the springs of the catapults were released explosively, killing dozens in their vicinities. Never have you imagined an army going to hell that quickly. It was a scene of utter chaos, and I had caused it. I took a lot of professional pride in that, but I wasn't done. At my signal, the gates below us were thrown open, the iron portcullis was raised, and the drawbridge was lowered, all in an instant. Every one of our horsemen charged into the suddenly unarmed, suddenly confused goblins, their lance heads, spear points, and swords flashing in the dim sunlight that managed to penetrate the clouds above. Behind them were most of our infantry, including 500 butter-stinking barbarians who looked as fierce as any Gavanni warrior. I was drained by the massive spell, but even drained, I still had plenty of power at my command with 2 shards of Irionite to draw from. I knew I would pay dearly later, but we had to press this momentary advantage as far as we could, or we risked all of our lives. I signaled Tyndall to begin the second phase of the spell, the easy part. The net was still active, and Garkescu still looked to our defense, but Tyndall no longer had to fool any shamans. He started casting another simple rune, the light rune Eos, into the blue flame. It's the one you use to activate a mage light. Only this time we weren't merely trying to illuminate. I fed power to him, as I was unable to concentrate on anything more complicated than that at the moment, and let him cast the spell. Below us, the dim battlefield suddenly flared with brilliance, as a light as bright as 12 torches suddenly blazed across it. It was a spectacular effect, and not without an impact on the battlefield. The nocturnal Gothani detested bright lights, and our men could suddenly see as clearly as under a clear noonday sun. The Battle of the Thousand Lights, as survivors called it later, had begun. I wish I could say that it was a total slaughter, a rout, but that simply wasn't the case. Our men fought hard and well, but the Gothani did not turn tail and flee in a mass, as we'd hoped. Oh, plenty of them did, but plenty more stayed to fight against our warriors with whatever scraps of weapons they could salvage from the pile of litter at their feet. They fought with savage bravery and vicious desperation, and many of our warriors died because of Gothani bravery. But enough of the enemy died too, and their siege-breaking plans were damaged. Within a half an hour, our Wilderlord cavalry were at the far edge of the field, establishing pickets and running down stragglers, while the mercenaries and the Crinrock mopped up the chaotic center around the five massive piles of firewood. I watched tiredly as our hairy warriors hewed goblins with their axes like so much kindling. The Crinrock fought with great spirit and a surprising amount of precision, and they provided a stable center in the battle for our more civilized warriors to depend upon for support and reinforcement. I just watched. As I said, I had done my part. What work was to be done had to be done quickly. I estimated we had an hour, maybe two, before the surviving generals would be able to gather a strong enough force of his sleeping warriors to retake the field. Gargescu was toning down his defenses. Nothing had challenged them yet, when Tyndall and I hurried down the stairs to join the fray. There a couple of stable boys were holding our horses already. In seconds, we were galloping across the field after the mercenary cavalry, the Thousand Lights casting our shadows a thousand times. It was daunting. I felt dizzy and giddy and elated and exhausted, but Traveller is an excellent mount. He passed corpses without reaction, and leapt piles of debris in our way, the heaps of wood and skins that had once been a frightening offense. I could see our targets by the glows of their witch stones, which were blazing brightly in my mage sight. There were seven of them scattered about the battlefield, and I aimed to gather every one, like a child gathers flowers in the spring. I'll spare you most of the gory details, the moans of the wounded and the cries of the dying, the gruesome sight of a young man in shock, vainly trying to stuff his intestines back into his body, the smell of a thousand bowels loosed in death. Battlefields are all much the same, and best to be avoided if possible. I had been in them before and didn't want to be in one now. I had a mission. I tried not to think about the countless horrors that were happening all around me as I busied myself, harvesting fistfuls of arcane power from the dead and dying shamans. Here and there we came to knots of real fighting, where a few goblins had taken defensive positions and were managing to not get slaughtered quite as quickly. We helped the conventional fighters when we could, blasting the goblins with our wands at propitious moments before they could regroup. But we primarily focused on racing to find the green amber nuggets we sought. The only time we stopped more than a dozen heartbeats was to witness a duel between a Gothani warrior and one of the Crinrock princes. Poznak, I believe. The Gothani had taken a longsword from the hand of one of our slain warriors, and was using it quite efficiently to keep the hulking, bearded mass of Poznak away. In his other hand, he held a stick of wood that may have been a section of spear once, and this he used to knock the great iron axe away. They stood toe to toe, surrounded by soldiers who were unwilling to take a victory away from their chieftain, but also unwilling to allow him to fight unreinforced. I reined Traveller to a stop, as Poznak was executing an intricate series of passes with his blade. If you have ever seen a Crinrock axeman in action, you know it is as graceful as an imperial silk dancer, and as bloody as a butcher. The Gervan he faced was doing a passable job blocking, but he was falling back slowly. The goblin returned the blows as well as he could, but the human-sized sword was too long for him to balance properly, and Poznak had the advantage. Still, the Gervan fought with amazing coolness, and when he exploded into a furious attack on the Crinrock prince, I was almost unsurprised to see his unwieldy blade suddenly hovering a half an inch above the furry throat of Poznak. We were about to be short a Crinrock prince. The muscular Gervan paused and looked around at the Humani warriors surrounding him, warriors who were preparing to strike on their own.
The Gervan glanced up to me, and then looked Poznak dead in the eye, and did the last thing I expected him to do. He threw down his blade and dropped to his knees in front of the Crinrock chieftain, chin held up proudly, black eyes squinting in the glow of the mage lights.
"Kill me, quickly, Humani,"
he said in passable, if accented, Narasi. Crinrock shrugged, hefted his axe, and was preparing to strike. Something tugged on me, though, and I commanded him to stop, emphasizing the point by magically holding the axe in the air.
"Wait," I said, pointing. "Do not kill him." "He fought well,"
Poznak objected, scowling.
"He deserves to die honorably."
"We need him alive. He speaks Narasi. Bind him and have him taken to the castle dungeon. I will interrogate him tonight."
"At once, master,"
Poznak said, motioning to two of his men. They took the goblin and bound his hands behind his back. After this victory, the Crinrock treated me with the respect usually reserved for their own princes. Poznak himself patted the goblin on his shoulder in a comradely manner, before returning to the mopping-up operations. It had been a good fight, and the Crinrock relish a good fight, like they enjoy rancid butter, but in a good way. I returned to my own task. We made our way to the site of the nearest ruined tower, where a group of our men were already hitching their horses to great timbers to be hauled back to the castle. Most were bloodstained and